Good evening. Welcome to the Flaherty Report. Today is Thursday, March 4th, 2012. I'm Catherine Alston-Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Our theme tonight is on faith, living in faith, and I wanted to quote Hebrews 11. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And what that means to me is that faith is the substance. If we're going to build a house, it's the bricks, it's the building blocks. And it's not something, it's not something that is unreal, it's very real. Scripture says it's the substance, and it's a very real substance. If we're going to build our world, the reason I wanted to talk about faith tonight is that, as I've said many times, we don't have an economic problem. We have a spiritual and cultural problem and a political problem. And the reality is that spiritual and cultural strength and power are the substance of building real economies and real wealth. And so if we want to talk about rebuilding the economy, which is what we're going to be spending several of our salary reports in March, we need to talk about where we get the substance to do that, and it starts with spiritual and cultural matters, and that brings us back to faith. And as Scripture tells us, that it is as substantive as the concrete material resources we use to build an economy, as real as land or water and precious metals. And my hope tonight is that every person listening will help get something from this, which will nurture your faith in your spiritual and cultural power to create the kind of world you want to live in. First, some this and that before money and markets. Hold those dates. I've been trying to have lunch with subscribers as I travel the country. What we're holding and we'll be in communication with you about is a lunch on Saturday in Tucson, March 17th in Austin, March 24th, that's Saturday at noon, and then April 14th in San Jose, and you'll be hearing more from us as we send the subscriber updates. I also wanted to let you know, in response to several subscriber requests, we have turned on the comment section on all blog posts for subscribers. So any blog post on the blog, there's, you can click on the comment button, and then you're also free, of course, just to comment in the section where it invites you to ask or post questions or other comments for the Salary Report. Finally, we've made the special report we did on foreign financial institution regulations and taxation very important this tax season. We've made it public, so you can send it far and wide beyond the subscriber group, and we would encourage you to do so just because that's such an important issue for this tax season. You can find it from the link at the bottom of our homepage under the special Salary Reports, or there's a link in your subscriber resource page. And if you haven't read that but do have more than $10,000 or $50,000 in a foreign financial institution, we really encourage you and encourage you to read that. It's very, very important. We're going to go extra time tonight, or at least several people have asked me not to talk so quickly. You can tell I grew up in Philadelphia and lived in New York. So I'm going to try and go more slowly, and but again, there'll be an MP3 and transcript, so if there's any problems, just pop in and see the transcript later. Money and markets, the economy, there's a lot going on in the economy, and if you read the news, you hear and see a lot about the economy. It's interesting, I continue to get just hundreds of emails every week about the things that are going wrong and really predicting an immediate collapse of the economy. And I want to break, there are three things happening at once, and I want to break them down for you and make sure you're looking at this correctly. There are three things going on. One is we're seeing a breakdown of trust as the systems change and cash flows in the old economy shrink. But literally, we're watching the birthing of a new economy and the breaking down of an old economy. And the birthing of the new is not just the pro-centralization team being evil, although certainly that's going on. But you're also seeing enormous creative destruction that comes from globalization and the birthing of new economies from that, as well as changes in technology. And, of course, they're interrelated because a lot of the globalization was anticipating or made possible by the new technology. I just saw there's a new company called Airbnb. I put a video by one of the founders up on the blog this week. They just raised $100 million that implies a valuation of $1 billion. This is a group of entrepreneurs who realized that they were going to get thrown out of the apartment if they didn't find a way to make their rent. And so they started, they put up a website and started renting an Airbed mattress in their living room. And it went from there. And literally you can travel all over the world finding rooms to rent in other people's houses or whole apartments and even chateaus and Lord knows what. Somebody rented their tent in the line. You know, they put up a tent to be first in line to get the new iPhone and rented a space in their tent. It's quite phenomenal, but to think that it is now very quickly at a valuation in the marketplace of $1 billion is quite extraordinary and speaks to the kind of creative destruction, because that $1 billion of valuation is valuation lost to a whole world of hotels and motels because the model's changing. I also put up a video on collaborative consumption about and like Airbnb, all sorts of different ways of consumers sharing materials. The, one of the famous examples, of course, is Zipcar, but you'll see lots of other examples in it. And again, it's part of the creative destruction that happens when you get a billion-plus people on pads and smartphones and suddenly having amazing computing power. With that in mind, we're working here at the Solera Report on an app, which we hope to have later this year, to make it easier for you to access the Solera Report from a phone or pad. Certainly the world is going that way. So part of what's happening in the economy is creative destruction, and it's making life very, very hard for the old models and the old corporations and the old governments. And yet there's a lot exciting and new that's happening. I mentioned we're trying to get Kickstarter on. We're scheduled for April. But that's an example of an organization like Airbnb or some of the collaborative consumption companies that's growing gangbusters. So we've got the creative destruction. We've got a recession. Part of that recession is not just a natural cycle recession. It's a post-bubble recession, and I think part of the housing bubble and other bubbles were in anticipation of seeing where the creative destruction was going to take us, and a variety of players trying to get the, as much money out of the old model as they could to position themselves for the new model. As those things happen, you're watching an enormous breakdown of trust. And, of course, trust is critical for an economy to go. That's part of why we're talking about living in faith tonight. How do we rebuild that trust? So these three things are interrelated, but they're all three happening at once. And it's a mistake to assume that it's all just a breakdown of trust or it's all just fraud, because the creative destruction and the globalization is very, very powerful. And it's very, very powerful, too, because you see many people predicting hyperinflation. We are inflating the money supply at hyperinflation rates, but we're also watching labor devaluation as a result of globalization and enormous deflation as a result of this kind of creative destruction. And that deflation to date has been in part used to set off the monetary inflation, and that's in part what the slow burn that I always talk about is about. More on European workouts. It's sort of what my stepmother used to call the endless agony. She was there. It comes again, the endless agony. And it's particularly disturbing. I put up a post from Zero Hedge on the blog talking about some of the provisions that the ECB has now put into the sovereign debt workouts. And you're literally watching creditors' rights being swept away in a way that is pretty lawless and very much of concern, but it's sort of the nature of the ongoing reengineering. Greece, as I said last week or 2 weeks ago, is choking on the inability to do evaluation. One of their challenges, and it's a challenge we face here, it's more subtle, but it's coming this way, which is how do we transact on Main Street when we don't have a currency we can use? I talked to Franklin Sanders today. He just got back from Nashville where he was testifying trying to get the state to stop charging a sales tax on sales of gold and silver. It is one of the things, there are many states that do not have a sales tax on precious metals, but there are some that do, and it's one of the things that's really standing in the way of creating an alternative liquidity important. We had Ron Paul grilling Pernicki yesterday and basically held up a silver coin and started to ask about why, you know, why the obstacle standing in the way of using this for liquidity and the importance of doing so. We saw precious metals take quite a trouncing yesterday, but then bounce back. It did look like a manipulation. I used to have a partner at Dillon Reed who'd say, you know, well, markets go up and down. The same thing is true of manipulated markets. So it doesn't mean much except they were able to bring precious metals down before the year end, or the monthly numbers were calculated. John Williams from ShadowStats has a great new report on hyperinflation. It's Hyperinflation 2012. It's got a lot of good statistics. It focuses a portion of the report on this problem of where do you get currency to transact with on Main Street given what's happening to the currency system and the sneaking up of inflation. He is now showing consumer inflation at 10%. Ouch. You know, so depending on how he calculates, it's at 6 to 10%, and that's part of the pain that people are feeling. The WebPOT program is now saying that we're going to have a real unwinding in March. I don't agree. March, however, is going to be a difficult time. We're coming into the season when the corporations have to pay their taxes on March 15th, and big SEC filings are due for those who have a corporate calendar year. It's going to be very, very painful. We're going to be talking about small business and how to rebuild the local economy. It's the appropriate time to do it. There's a lot more interest. I spoke about that up in the Rogue Valley in Oregon and then to a group in Emeryville, and we've got a ton of questions and some real sustainable interest, so we'll see what happens. But it's one of the reasons we've now scheduled Joe Mizak of Bloomberg. He's just got a new book out on, in my opinion, the best financial markets reporter on municipal bonds, and I think more and more people have a lot of questions about what all these changes are going to mean for the credit quality of their municipal bonds, because you have not only the economic changes, but the changes in the bond markets and U.S. deficits. We see Wyoming legislators coming up with a plan for meltdown, and I described that on the blog. That post is on the blog, but it kind of makes you wonder, well, you know, if you're holding any Wyoming municipal bonds, should you continue to do so? Ask Catherine a couple good questions. Catherine, my husband, and I have been members for a couple years and have always had great and beneficial opportunity to consult with you. We are continually researching and inquiring on methods and tools for preserving and building wealth. After coming across the concept on infinite banking, we're currently reading Bank on Yourself by Pamela Yellen. Because we're such avid readers, listeners of the Solari Report, we're wondering if you might share your opinion on the use of this particular insurance policy as a financial financing vehicle as well as part of the tax strategy. I bought the book today in response to this question. I just wanted to let you know. I've never met a whole life a financing vehicle that I liked, but I'm always open. And I don't know this one, so I'm going to go ahead and read and hope to have an answer for you by the next Solari Report or the one after that. Second question, I found these links today. What do you make of all these resignations? And they sent a series of links on CEOs resign, police chiefs resign, bankers resign, and a quote from Benjamin, or a note from Benjamin Fulford, the resignation of the heads of the World Bank, Credit Suisse, the Bank of India, the planned resignation, the head of Goldman Sachs, et cetera, et cetera. I must have gotten 20 of these this week, and I have to tell you, I don't settle on them. If you click through to some of the links, you'll find that there's very sloppy reporting of what the real headline is or what's really said in the article, or the articles span over a very long period of time. And if you look at the number of banks and institutions involved in what's going on in the world, particularly the creative destruction, it's not surprising at all that you would see a lot of resignations. We have an older generation getting their money out. We've got a market top with a lot of insiders selling. It's just the time that people decide to take their money and move. But the other thing is, if you look at the leadership that have run those institutions or that part of the market, it's really time for turnover. So it doesn't necessarily mean as much as is implied by these emails. Now, it could. We'll have to see. But creative destruction and a changing of the guard is enough to produce lots and lots of turnover at a time like this. Remember, we ballooned the financial system, and now we're sort of re-engineering that post-bubble, and it's not surprising that lots of the top managers and middle managers are getting re-engineered out of position. Third person says, may I recommend the book Secret Weapon by Kevin Freeman? His blog can be found here. Might be a good guest possibility. I'll definitely check it out. Our hero tonight is Seattle, or a group in Seattle, let me describe. Seattle announced, and this is on the blog, they're going to convert their public area, a piece of their public land, to the first public food forest in the United States. If you look at one of the great re-engineering opportunities nationwide, it's that the public spaces, particularly in our municipalities, be re-landscaped into edible landscapes. It's one of the things I love that the permaculturalists have come up with. In the lead is something called the Friends of the Food Forest. So it's called the Beacon Food Forest Project. The landscape architect is Margaret Harrison. You can read more about it at the blog, but kudos to Friends of the Food Forest and Margaret Harrison. You're our hero this week. Interestingly enough, the idea came out of a permaculture design course group project and just blossomed into a website and a neighborhood outreach and finally into something that got Seattle to take, apparently it's going to be 6 acres, and turn it into a food forest. We posted on the blog a wonderful article about a town in England which had done this, where you could literally on your way home you just start picking the food if you need it. And that's apparently what this is going to be. If the food is ready to harvest and you're walking by, you just take it. So good for you, Seattle. Living in Faith. Our interview tonight is not with someone else. It's just with me. I wanted to talk to you tonight about a series of issues that need to be addressed before we can talk about reengineering money, because the financial system, any financial system and any economy, operate on the foundation of our values, our laws, our cultural practices, and our community and connection to each other. One of my favorite quotes is from the skater, the ice hockey player, Wayne Gretzky. Somebody asked him why he was so successful as a skater, even though he was really short. And he said, I skate to where the puck will be. And I want to talk about these things tonight, which are going to be at the heart of the matter in the transformation we're going to. I want to skate to where the puck will be in terms of the big issues. Over the next couple of weeks, I'll be talking about a lot of nuts and bolts. But none of those nuts and bolts are going to matter, you know, 2 cents, unless we are prepared to deal with the very big issues. When I was in the Rogue Valley, I did a series of nuts and bolts workshops, first on household investment and then on community currency and reengineering both municipal and equity money in a place, and realized at the final dinner that we needed to talk about basically the big basic issues. And so a lot of what I'm going to say was inspired by the conversation that we had up here. My comments tonight are organized in 5 areas. They are faith, freedom, leadership, law, and love. And before I start, I want to read a story that's kind of cross-cutting and is an important metaphor that runs beneath all of my comments tonight. And it's a quote from a rather long quote from Jung. It's up on the blog under the title, Karma Means You Don't Get Away with Anything. And I first heard this story described by a wonderful investment manager in London at a conference, and for many years tried to find the exact reference, which it turns out it is in Carl Jung's book, Memories, Dreams, Reflections. And wonderful subscriber who's a great scholar on Jung finally found it for me, and I put it up on the blog. Let me read it to you. I once had a similar case, which I've never forgotten. A lady came to my office. She refused to give her name, said it did not matter since she wished to have only one consultation. It was apparent that she belonged to the upper levels of society. She had been a doctor, she said. What she had to communicate to me was a confession. Some 20 years ago, she had committed a murder out of jealousy. She had poisoned her best friend because she wanted to marry her friend's husband. She had thought that if the murder was not discovered, it would not disturb her. She wanted to marry the husband, and the simplest way was to eliminate her friend. Moral considerations were of no importance to her, she thought. The consequences. She had, in fact, married the man, but he died soon afterward, relatively young. During the following years, a number of strange things happened. The daughter of this marriage endeavored to get away from her as soon as she had grown up. She married young and vanished from view, drew further and further away, and ultimately the mother lost all contact with her. The lady was a passionate horsewoman and owned several riding horses of which she was extremely fond. One day she discovered that the horses were beginning to grow nervous under her. Even her favorite shied and threw her. Finally, she had to give up riding. Thereafter, she clung to her dog. She owned an unusually beautiful wolfhound to which she was greatly attached. As chance would have it, this very dog was stricken with paralysis. With that, her cup was full. She felt that she was morally done for. She had to confess, and for that purpose she came to me. She was a murderess, but on top of that, she also murdered herself. For one who commits such a crime destroys his own soul. The murderer had already passed sentence on himself. If someone has committed a crime and is caught, he suffers judicial punishment. If he has done it secretly without moral consciousness of it and remains undiscovered, the punishment can nevertheless be visited upon him, as our case shows. It comes out in the end. Sometimes it seems as if even animals and plants know it. As a result of the murder, the woman was plunged into unbearable loneliness. She had even become alienated from animals. Wait a minute, it skipped. She had even become alienated from animals. She had seen people and animals turn away from her and had been so struck by this silent verdict that she could not have endured any further condemnation. Now, I think that that story holds a special meaning for Americans because it's worth thinking as we shift out of a world where things are assured for us by the wealth of our society to one where we need to be friends with each other, with the birds, with the animals, with all of creation. If we're going to gather the power to build a new economy, then we need to think about what, as I used to call, we come clean and start to be worthy of the support of the birds. As the investment manager I once heard once upon a time talk about this, he said, wherever she was, the birds had stopped singing. And I think the question before us is how can we make sure that the birds are singing for us? So let me start with faith. What do I mean by faith? Spiritually, I'm a Christian, but it's not my purpose in this talk or generally in my work to encourage you to adopt my particular spiritual faith or even to describe my particular spiritual faith in detail. You know, it's not, I guess, a minister's goal is to encourage you to have a particular practice, and I guess at the root of things, I'm an investment advisor and a money person and not a minister. But I may refer to Scripture because that is my practice, and I hope that if I say anything in my tradition that you will convert it or translate it to one appropriate to your spiritual or philosophic practice. So having cleared that, let me begin again and say, what do I mean by faith? By faith, I mean the ability to create your world as opposed to buy into or be forced into a different kind of world than the one that you want to live in by someone who insists they have the right to create your world for you. So faith is the ability to picture the world you want to live in, and it is the substance, as I said before from the scripture from Hebrew. Faith is the substance. It's the building block that you create to create that world. Faith is something which is invisible, but it is as real and as powerful as the material building blocks that we use, such as land or precious metals or water or any of the you know, the other material things. And I think the time has come where we need to treat it as is as real and as substantive as we treat those other things. We had a great interview with John Rappaport several weeks ago, and I wanted to do the interview with Rappaport because I wanted you to hear and have access to the interviews that really describe the nuts and bolts about how other people try and create and manipulate us into the world that they want. And a wonderful client of mine sent John an email and gave me permission to share it with you. She wrote, "John, I'm a client of Catherine's and heard your interview. I bought Matrix Nuts and Bolts." That's the name of his collection of interviews. "It has been so liberating to know about these things. It was a huge affirmation, affirming that I don't buy a lot of the news stories for quite a while because they don't ring true. I couldn't explain why and mostly kept it to myself. Now I know why. That these elites have created this reality has actually inspired me that I can create my own reality more than any proclaiming that creating your own reality is possible by any of the many New Age speakers. I feel it is partly because of your benevolent intent and energy for your readers that my response was not to get more depressed over this material, which I feared would happen. Also that the truth will set you free. Thanks for your enlightening work." She was referring to the interviews by Ellis Medavoy, who was a pretty senior PR guy, or that's a pseudonym, who literally used to create propaganda and false realities. But it was inspiring. This email was inspiring to me because it was something that had encouraged the person listening to understand the power that is used to create a world for us and to understand, wow, we can do that too. Let me tell you two other stories that come to mind about this issue of creating our own world. I had a wonderful friend. We were in Montana in 2005, and we were over in Helena and went into a conference, and there turned out to be a group of energetic healers. And I'd been trying to explain what energetic healing was to my friend and asked the energetic healers gathered to explain to him. And they tried. They spent about an hour, and he's a pretty concrete guy. And we were driving back that night over the mountains, and he's trying to sort it out in his mind. What is this thing called energetic healing, and, you know, this thing called the field, and this thing called spiritual intelligence and power, and it's all seemed kind of woozy to him. And suddenly he screeches his car to the stop. We're driving about 100 miles an hour. He screeches his car to a halt, and he turns to me and he said, "If what these people are saying is really true, then the good guys can win." I said, "That's right." And then he said, "Well, and if what they're saying is not true, they're still important because people like you believe it's true." I said, "That's right." The second story was I was driving down, I used to work late when I started Hamilton, and I had a black Corvette, which we nicknamed Fred. So I was driving Fred down the George Washington Parkway, and I had a big glass house overlooking the Potomac and McLean. So I was driving Fred back, and I was listening to a tape of The Dancing Woolly Masters. And it's a very popular book that sort of is an introduction to quantum physics. And it was describing the experiment in which two particles of light acted in concert further than the distances of the speed of light and sound, demonstrating the properties of a shared intelligence. And it was 11 o'clock at night, and I got out of the car, walked up and down along the parkway screaming, "I knew it, I knew it, I knew it," because what they were describing was the kind of shared intelligence that Lynn McTaggart writes about in The Field, and it's one of the reasons I so was delighted that Lynn was able to be on the Soleri Report, and you were able to get an introduction to both her work in The Field and her newest book, The Bond. There have been other moments in the Soleri Report that are important to underscore here, and again, it's one of the reasons I have some of them on. Bill Tiller did an interview where he talked about the power of intention and his scientific experiments, which prove that intention can influence the material world. We had a great one. My favorite quotes last year was from Dr. Gwen Scott, who said to me in her discussion on chemtrails, she said, you know, the most important thing you need to understand is if you look at what's been happening, we should all be dead, but we're not, which means something else is going on. And we had a conversation about grace and the power of whatever's going on to compost the evil, and things turn out differently. And finally, Foster Gamble was an important conversation in this vein, because one of the things we talked about was the criticality to a global, or to create a global covenant with respect for the individual and non-violation, the importance of the rights of one. We have had in the United States of America a covenant coming from the Constitution, and I would say it was a spiritual covenant, which is one of the reasons I think it's so important. But we've had a covenant of respecting each other's individual rights, and yet we finance that covenant by not respecting the rights of billions of people around the world. And what globalization means, we don't need to destroy the Constitution. Please don't let that happen. But we do need to extend that covenant, both spiritually and legally, to include every human being on the planet. And that involves the resources and how we govern, because we can say we respect another's human rights, but if we're debasing their money and stealing their natural resources at 10 cents on the dollar, then we're not doing that. So those are some comments on faith. Faith is the substance. Let's talk about freedom. The Declaration of Independence says, let me read it to you, and I can't, unless you go back and read the Constitution and the Declaration, because I think they're brilliant and wise documents. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. As a friend of mine says, freedom is an inside job. We are approaching a point where it's time to really face that what we're dealing with is not about corruption, it's not about money, it's about freedom. Will we live as free people, or will we live as slaves or not, or debt? I mean, that ultimately is what this is about, because if you look at what's happening economically, the planet is being harvested, and the single most profitable business on the planet today is slavery. Now, there are many different kinds of slavery, but if you just look at the worst form of and the most concrete form of slavery, you know, it's bigger than ever. The African slave trade looks like nothing compared to what's going on. There's a new movie out. We'll do it on Let's Go to the Movies sometime in the next couple months, called The Whistleblower. It's a fictional version of the story of an actual whistleblower who brought a lawsuit about sex slave trafficking by U.S. and U.N. contractors in Eastern Europe. And it's a very reputable movie about exactly what is going on today. It's important to understand, because I've lived with them and dealt with them, that the people running things are slave traders. They believe and practice physical slavery. They believe and practice mind control slavery. Yes, you know, if you look at that review of Aaron Rousseau that I posted in my article, The Data Beast, you know, they absolutely would want to put chips in everybody and make them slaves. So it's important to understand where some of the leadership is going here. They look at managing 7 billion people the way a farmer looks at managing a bunch of chickens. It's funny, you can understand a lot more about what's going on if you really read and study livestock management. And the problem that many people in the middle class, both in Europe and America, have, but particularly in America, is we don't have a lot of spiritual and moral standing, because generally as a group, we've supported the genocide as long as we could pretend we weren't doing it, and we benefit financially. I've spent my entire lifetime watching drugs and hard narcotics being brought into minority communities, and the game, which you know, was in the Black community was referred to as the beatdown. I mean, the beatdown game is going has been going on for many decades with hard narcotics trafficking, but it was going on with many other things for decades and decades before. You know, and if you want to go back and look at where we got all the land, I'm sure if we did title searches all the way back, what we discover is the land was stolen from Indians who were genocided. So whether it was the genocide practice globally to get natural resources cheap, or the genocide practice to get the land we have, or the genocide that's been used to sort of target minority neighborhoods, the reality is that we in this country have gone along with a lot of it and done and said nothing. So there's a cycle of disrespect between the leadership and all of us, because their feeling is that, you know, as long as we get a piece of the action and can pretend that we didn't do it, we're happy to go along. And that puts us on the, it puts us morally off sides, and it has created this cycle of disrespect. The, it's funny, I talked, when I talked to Franklin today, one of the things Franklin and I talk about is how, to a certain extent, the process that we went through in the 90s is a process that now everyone is going through. So the beatdown that hit the African-American neighborhoods in the 70s and that hit us early on in the 80s, since we seem to refuse to mind our own business, is now something that is kind of spreading everywhere. And for me, it's an interesting process emotionally, because this is a force that I've dealt with off and on throughout my life and tried to warn people about. And to a certain extent, most people couldn't fathom it until it really came out of the closet. And now as the beatdown spreads to upper middle class and middle class neighborhoods and the debasement accelerates, I think it's much easier for everyone to see it. But ultimately, this is about freedom. And what you've seen is the time that the crowd sits down and really wins is when they literally decide to draw a line in the sand and say, no, I'm not going along with that. So swine flu was a perfect example. When the swine flu vaccine was mandated, you had a whole group of people draw a line in the sand and say, no, we're not going to do that. We don't care if you fire us. We don't care, you know, if you fine us. We don't care. And it ballooned, and sure enough, an incredible effort to get mandated vaccines and to push that vaccine got stopped dead in its tracks. It's one of the things John Rappaport and I talked about when we spoke. Another one is homeschooling, because parents are ferocious about what you do to their kids, and the homeschoolers and homeschooling has grown steadily. There's nothing that the powers that be would love more than to control the curriculum and education of all kids, and yet they haven't been able to do that because literally the homeschooling movement just, you had too many people who were willing to engage in civil disobedience. And so what you see again and again is the time that tyranny gets backed up is when people say, you know, here's my line, I will not cross it, and they get very, very ornery. And I assure you, one of the things that the guys in the top are very concerned about is that people can be very, very ornery. And so that's why divide and conquer is so important. Okay, so we've talked about faith. We've talked about the fact that this is about freedom, and it's really important for you to decide where your lines are and where you're prepared to stand, because, in fact, that's when the miracles start to happen. Let's talk about leadership. In a decentralized world, you know, we are the leaders. I'll never forget in 1998 sitting in the office with my attorney and her talking about, you know, we really have to get somebody to help us. And I turned to her and I said, don't you understand? Nobody's going to help us. We are the leaders. She looked at me and said, it can't possibly be that bad. And I said, yeah, it is. And I think she would agree with me today. We cannot let our enemies define for us who our leaders are. And this is a point that I'm going to make over and over again because it is so important. When I first went to visit Franklin, I was looking and doing due diligence on precious metals dealers, and I really needed a dealer I could trust. And so I talked to Franklin, and I interviewed him, and I researched, and I read all those articles about his background, and I got references on him. And finally I came to him, and I said, okay, I want you to be the dealer who will help my clients. This was in 2004. He said, well, you can't possibly refer me, you know, because the Department of Justice came after me. And I said, oh, well, that's one of the things that it's one of your strongest credentials, because you understand what the law is. You're prepared to be the law because you know we can't depend on the government or the courts to be the law. So I need somebody who understands that and is prepared to hold the line even in the face of all of that, and who understands that their word has to be that impeccable. So you understand that we have to be our own law, and that when you're talking about somebody's money, you're not talking about their money in that situation. You're talking, you may be talking about their life. So I need somebody who understands it's about people's lives, not their money, and that they have to be the law no matter what. And Franklin looked at me and he said, well, I just don't think your clients are going to tolerate anybody who was charged by the Department of Justice. And, you know, sure enough, that has not been a problem. But I have watched literally so many people in my life let their leader be defined by who Time Magazine says is the leader, or to take a really honorable person who's doing right by them, have them targeted by, you know, the bad guys, whether it's the media or the government, and they throw them overboard. And so literally they're in a process where the people they depend on are the ones who are beholden to their enemies, or the people who don't have their best interest at heart, whereas they're constantly throwing overboard the people they can trust. I remember I wrote an article called The Community Wizard of Sebastopol, and it describes what I'm about to tell you. I did a speaking tour and ended up speaking in Sebastopol, and I kept being told by the various people in the community, oh, we don't have people who can help us with that, and we don't have people who can help us with that. And digging down, I discovered, yes, they did. They had tons and tons of great people in the municipal government, in the financial community there. They had great bankers. And when I said to them, look, you know, here's this guy. He's fabulous. He's been a, you know, he's knowledgeable. He's honest. He's dedicated. He cares tremendously about the community. He's been on the planning board. He's done this, he's done that. What came out was he hadn't been in Time Magazine. He hadn't gotten an award from Harvard. He hadn't been anointed by the corporate media and the hierarchy. And so the leadership in that community was in a complete double bind, because if they did what was in the best interest of the people in that community, they would not be considered a hero, because they wouldn't get any of those awards or attention from the corporate media, which was interested in making money harvesting the place. So they were promoting an entirely different kind of leadership, one that didn't have necessarily the best interest of the community at heart. So there was a multiple personality disorder in the whole thing that got unbelievable. Well, in the summer, another story. In the summer of 2000, and I wrote this up in Narco Dollars to Beginners, I was at a revival for Christian women in Atlanta. And T.D. Jakes brought George W. Bush in by monitor. It was the year of the presidential campaign. And 100,000 African-American women jumped up cheering, including a minister that I was taking spiritual warfare class from, who used to work for the DEA. And there's nothing about hard narcotics trafficking in this country that she doesn't know about, including allegations related to both the Clinton and the Bush family. So she jumped up cheering for George W. Bush. And afterwards, I said, you know, I just almost lost my life. I've lost my fortune, everything else, trying to stop hard narcotics trafficking by these guys. And you just jumped up cheering for one of them. And I want to know why. And she said, well, he's going to be the winner. And I said, so I'm a loser and he's a winner. And she said, yeah, that's right. Now, what I have to tell you is, if you're Franklin Sanders or you're Catherine Austin Fitz or the hundreds of other people like us, you do what you do, as we would say in Scripture, for the glory of God, not because the crowd will support you. And this is a conundrum that we all have to deal with, because we are all susceptible to the trance of what corporate media promotes. And that's one of the great things about the creative destruction, because more and more we can find each other through the internet. We can find each other through YouTube. We can, you know, we can be our own media, and it gives us the power to start to switch things. But part of what we need to do is we need to define our brands and take our brands from sources that we know and believe to have our best interests at heart. There is nothing more important than that, because if people who do not have your best interests at heart can define what makes you a leader or define what makes the people around you a leader, then there are no solutions. And that brings us back to handicaps as well, because one of the most brilliant things that the powers that be do is they put enormous handicaps on the true leaders, whereas they do lots of things to put wind in the sail of the people who are, you know, of course, helping facilitate the harvesting of places and industries for them. And so literally you can have someone like a Franklin dealing with just unbelievable headwinds while someone else is sailing in. Not only do they have no handicaps, they have lots of money and help from the powers that be. So one of the things you need to think about when you judge when you judge a horse running around the track is how much weight is the jockey and the horse carrying. Okay, what does this all mean to you in terms of taking action? One of the stories you've heard from me on many occasions is the story of Gideon. It's one of my favorite stories in the Old Testament, and it's in Judges chapter 6 to 9. Gideon is a shepherd in Israel, and Israel has been occupied by these evil, horrible people called the Midianites, and an angel of the Lord comes down to Gideon and says, Gideon, we want you to throw the Midianites out of Israel. And Gideon says, wait a minute, I'm the last son in the last family in the last tribe. I'm a shepherd. I'm not a warrior. I have no idea how to do this. And so the angel of the Lord says, well, you know, you're not going to do it. We're going to do it. The reason we chose you is everyone will know it was, you know, the Lord who did it, because clearly you're incapable. So Gideon goes ahead and he calls for an army, and a whole bunch of people show up. And the angel of the Lord comes back and says, well, you know, you got a whole lot of people, but they're not all faithful. They're not all believers. They don't really believe, you know, in the power of the divine intelligence to get something done here. So they make Gideon do a series of tests and send the scared guys home. I used to have a partner and say, before you get together to rob the bank, you need to send the scared guys home. So Gideon sends the scared guys home. And then the angel of the Lord comes back and says, well, you got rid of the scared guys, but now you still have people who are not competent. And Gideon has to put them through another test, and he ends up sending all the incompetent people home and ends up with an army of only 300 people. He's apoplectic. How's he going to throw the Midianites out of Israel with only 300 guys? And he comes down the side of the valley in the dark with lanterns and pitchers, so light and noise. And the Midianites are sleeping in the valley, and the Midianites jump up in the dark and start killing each other. And so, hence, Gideon's army throws the Midianites out of Israel. And the meaning of that story is, if there's anything you need in this environment, it's people who are both faithful and competent. And I cannot stress that enough. When we're in a stable society or we're in a bubble, when we can count on the system to be reliable, you know, it's easy to get along with a whole lot of people. In an environment where you're inventing a new world, where the world is very tricky, where there's a lot of risk, suddenly it's not important to have a lot of people. What's important is to have people who have great integrity and who are competent. And, of course, the way to do that is to do our very best to try and be that ourselves. If you want to look back on our website, we have an article called Coming Clean. And part of that is sort of, okay, if I want to attract to me other faithful and competent people, how can I be and do more to become more faithful and more competent? Another story I wanted to tell was one of the things I used to watch at the Department of Housing and Urban Development a lot. There were a lot of very wonderful, in the bureaucracy, very wonderful civil servants, and they would be doing an excellent job at their work. And then suddenly, whack, the black budget guys would come down and yell at them for doing what they were supposed to be doing, but the black budget guys didn't want it to be done. And, of course, suddenly everybody would hurtle to a state of lack of clarity because no one really wanted to deal with what was really going on. It was too scary. And suddenly they would take that portion of what they were doing that they still controlled and could still get done and suddenly reinvent it as much more complicated. And every year the processes involved would get more and more complicated and more and more complicated and more and more complicated. And for a variety of reasons, that worked for the black budget guys. But you had a growth in the smallness of mind. You had a growth in meanness. And you had a growth in people attacking each other. And it was literally as the corruption was moving in on them, they would continually increase complexity, increase smallness of mind, increase the divide and conquer. It was their way of coping with it. Now, as the beatdown continues as society, as cash flows recede in the old world, and people are having trouble moving to the new world, we're seeing the same thing. People making things more complicated, a smallness of mind, sort of a growth in the rate of entropy, more divide and conquer. Scripture says, you can tell it's the last days, when the spirit of offense rises and people take offense or give offense much faster. Don't fall into that trap. You need to, all solutions come from staying in a higher mind, but you're going to be watching that in many places. And it's one of the reasons you want to stick with people that both have integrity and are competent in this environment, who do not go down in that spiral, because that's a spiral you can't afford to get caught up in. It's one that's going to get less and less productive, and if anything, you need to get more and more productive. One of the ways you see it is, unfortunately, more and more of our society has gotten highly dependent on government money, and that tends to draw people into that model. They get dependent on the government money, and then the government money and benefits starts shrinking, ratcheting back, and being debased, and, of course, that makes it worse. One of the reasons I wanted to have Adam Trombley on the Solidarity Report to talk about entrainment technology is I feel that a lot of the wireless technology and the entrainment technology gets in the way of this, whether it's promoting certain kind of mind controls, certain kind of moods, or it just shuts us off from the divine intelligence and our ability to resonate with each other. And that concerns me very much. So it's another reason I try and stay in nature or in trees or do things in my environment to kind of protect from that. Couple other comments. Faith is the substance of things hoped for but not seen. I would say if faith is number one, then number two, number three, number four, number five are habits, good habits. And when you have a world that is as corrupt as this one and is changing as fast as this one, it is very hard to maintain successful habits. I know my habits got flattened by my experience in the litigation. But think about that and focus on that, because what you will see over many years is people who are able to maintain successful habits, even when those around us can't, it makes an enormous difference, an enormous difference in this environment. One of the reasons, last comment, that I propose doing circles is that if we're going to rebuild an economy, we're going to need trust, and a small circle that's made up of only those people you can trust to share confidential financial and personal data is a building block from which we can start to build liquidity in a community so that you don't have to trust everyone. A small circle can trust each other. It's like an affinity group, and then circles can do deals with each other, and you can build out from there. Law is the next one. So let me say a few words about law. Financial systems begin and end with laws. Financial systems are man-made systems, and they are based on the rules that we make about how we make contracts and how we transact with each other and how we store value. It's a man-made system. And so no laws, no financial system. I've often said, and you can read this in the Dylan Reed story, that if you look at the price-earnings ratio of the stock, let's say a stock is trading at a price-earnings ratio of $20 or 20, a multiple of 20 times, for every dollar of income, its stock value is 20. Well, you take away the rule of law, and in fact, you know, the PE is going to drop to 1 or something like that. And so liquidity very much depends, and value depends on the rule of law. And that's why so much money and time has been put into creating the appearance of law, because if you can combine illegal cash flows with, you know, high PEs and high financial liquidity, then you've really got a money-making machine. And one of the things the financial system is struggling with is, as it becomes more apparent, the level of corruption, how do you keep the high liquidity and PEs going when, in fact, there's less and less faith in the rule of law? That's the sort of MF Global situation. I mentioned, and it's described again in that article, Community Wizard of Sebastopol, the mandate of heaven, which is the Chinese notion of the support or the credibility of a ruler and what a ruler needs to do in the moral order of the universe to command support from heaven for his rule, the notion being that without that you can't rule. What we're watching, and this is part of the reengineering underway, is sovereign governments around the world lose the mandate of heaven, which raises the question, well, how are we going to rebuild the mandate of heaven someplace else, even if it's in our own lives, our own household, in our own circles, in our own communities? And it's one worth thinking about, because that's exactly what we're going to have to do. I told this story in the Dylan Reed, and I want to, in the Dylan Reed book, and I wanted to tell it again about something that happened to me. It's one of those important moments in my process. I was in in 1998, and we had been attacked by a barrage. We were under a barrage of 12 different pieces of litigation, and I needed the insurance company's attorneys, or because I had litigation in other states and couldn't fund that myself. And so I finally met with a group of the most high-powered, high-priced attorneys to brief them for a day on what was going on in the litigation around Hamilton. And at one point, one of the insurance company's attorneys who'd been brought in, the insurance company was trying to get us to accept them for representation, ordered me to do something that would have been a violation of a contract that I had made with a subcontractor. And I refused to do it. And I said, you know, I agreed with the subcontractor that if we had a political problem, it was our problem, not theirs, and I'm not going to abrogate my contract. And the attorney said, well, if you don't do what we tell you, we're going to withdraw representation, and if we withdraw representation, then you're going to go to prison because, you know, you won't have lawyers to defend you, et cetera, et cetera. And I stopped, and I said, I'll just read it. It's in the article. I said, gentlemen, I'm obedient to the laws of God, and there's nothing you can say or do that will cause me to violate them. If that means I'm going to jail, then I'm going to jail, if only to organize the last group of entrepreneurs I need to run the country when the government collapses, because if people like me are going to prison, then it's only a matter of time until the government fails. And it was really interesting. This happened several times in litigation when I just said, no, I'm not going to lie, I'm not going to break my word, I'm not going to abrogate a contract, I'm not going to do that, period, for anything, end of discussion. Now, what was really interesting about this was, here was a lawyer threatening me with the end of the world if I didn't do what he said. He told me several months later that that was the first time it occurred to him that we might win. And I said to him, so you ordered me to do something that if I did it would cause you to believe that we were going to lose. Why would you do that? It was amazing when I said the first statement to all the attorneys, I had 12 different attorneys staring down at their shoes like little boys. And I said to them, I didn't write it in the article, I said, why did you guys become lawyers? You don't believe in the law. And one of the things you understand if you end up dealing with important legal questions is there really is such a thing as law. but it is not something that's in books. It's not something that's in, in a judge's chamber. Law is something that we practice and we live, and if it's not deeply embedded in our faith and in our philosophies and in our culture, it has no meaning. And so, as I said to Franklin, I need a precious metal stealer who will be the law. If we're going to be leaders, each one of us, then we need to be the law. Should it have to be that way? No, but that's the way it's going to be. We're going to have to be the law. I'm not going to talk a lot tonight about the Solarian model, which is sort of my model of how we re-engineer the practices, the important best practices of how we manage money, including pension fund and institutional capital. But the reality is we're going to a world where we can't just assume, oh, government will enforce and take care of that. And so, part of the Solarian model is trying to institutionalize the law into financial protocols in a world where sovereign governments either go away or can't be depended on. But it all comes down, as always, to the enforcement question. If you look at the laws that govern our pension fund and institutional capital, there's a lot of great laws, and if they were being followed, a lot more things would work. But the problem is that the people leading that money, literally, if they don't do what they're told top down, they literally can fear for their life or their position or anything else. So it always comes back to the enforcement question, who's going to enforce? And the reality is, if you look at what's going on, there's only one way, and that is if every one of us does in how we live and how we transact our money. Let's talk about love. And the first thing I want to say about love is I want to talk about anger. I wrote an article for the blog, it's up on the blog, about anger, and I tell the story of when I was dealing with litigation again, sort of 1998, so my version of dealing with a beatdown. I it never occurred to me that I couldn't figure out a way to win in the situation, and finally, as things got to be sort of long-lived and overwhelming, I sat down and I said, this is really serious. I could die. And it was a pretty sobering moment. And so I sat down and I said, look, other people have been in this situation. I'm going to study who else has been in this situation, and I'm going to study who won and who lost and why. What were the conditions that led to their success? And I should just mention we did a wonderful interview with Lawrence Gonzalez on a book called Deep Survival, which gets into many of the same questions I ended up addressing here, and which I recommend to all of you. You'll need to read this book. But one of the things I discovered is many of the people who had survived or gone through the beatdown failed because of their anger. They became so angry at what was happening, and their anger literally poisoned them, and if anything caused physical disabilities, their anger made them sick. Their anger caused them to drive away the people around them who they needed to help them and to support them. And what I realized was I needed to work my way through the situation, and I needed to organize everything so that when it was over, I had the capacity to love and that I was building a future defined by who and what I loved rather than defined by my anger. And it completely caused me to reorganize what I did and how I did it. It was a very different way of going about the process. But one of the things it taught me was a piece of advice, again, from Scripture, from St. Paul, when he said, let not the sun go down on your anger. There's another phrase from Scripture I love. All things work together for the good of them that love the Lord and are called according to his purpose. What it means is you never know how things turn out. Once upon a time, I worked for people who I didn't respect and admire. I've worked for very powerful and famous people who I believed were murderers, who I believed were pedophiles, who, I did not respect and I didn't like. And I thought that in the world that I lived in. You know, you had no choice. You were a good soldier, and sometimes you got to work for people you liked, and sometimes you didn't. I serve now. I work with people who are wonderful. I've been traveling the country and meeting with subscribers, and I certainly meet with my clients and some of my investors. These are wonderful people. In fact, they're people who hold up the world, and that's, I shouldn't say they, you. All of you are taking care of mothers and fathers and children and grandchildren. You're holding down the fort in all sorts of different industries. You're doing amazing jobs under difficult circumstances. The world is full of people who are exceptionally responsible and really do believe they can build their own world and invent their own world, and you're doing it. And there are many, many of you. And I would never have the opportunity to know you and work for you if I hadn't gotten thrown out of Washington. So, which is to say that sometimes when things are going on that feel horrible, they're part of getting you to where you need to go that's a lot more wonderful. Sometimes what's intended for your evil can be working out for your good, and it's very important to not forget that. So I would encourage you. I'm often asked from people, where can I go and what can I do so that I will be safe? And I'm always saying, you know, there is no way. The forces of tyranny that we're dealing with are everywhere. And there are different variables that can define which places for you might be safer than others. So I'm not saying that is not a worthwhile exercise. It is. But what each one of us needs to ask is, where are the people I love? What is my purpose? Who do I wish to serve? And how and where do I want to build, you know, the world that I want to be a part of? Because the transformation is going to have if we all leave the old world and go to build the new world, and there's not enough time to organize yourself against what you don't want to be a part of. You need to organize everything around what your purpose is, and where your purpose is, that's where you're safe, because that's where the spiritual and cultural forces are going to protect you. So ask, don't ask where you're safe, ask where, who and what you can best serve and what is your highest and best purpose. And I would hope that you would also organize it so no matter what, you don't lose your capacity to love. When we talked with Lynn McTaggart about the bond, that's what we were talking about, the importance of the heart for nourishing and creating the things that we're all nourishing and creating now. Now let me say a few things about our movie, because the movie is very on point to the things we're talking about tonight and about living in faith. It's called As It Is in Heaven, and if you haven't watched it, I just can't recommend it to you enough. It's a Swedish movie, yes, it's subtitles, and it's the story of a world-class musician. He leaves a small town in Sweden as a young child because of bullying. He's being bullied by kids who are beating him up. He becomes a very famous, successful musician, and then because of the stress, develops heart and health problems. And then retires back and decides to go back to the little town where he grew up in. And lo and behold, he ends up leading the church choir. Now, the story is about how does a group of people get into accord at a very deep level? And what you see in the movie is a group of people who as the production goes on and as this world-class musician forces them to work well together, they have to clear all these issues, and all these old hurts and all these old lies and all these betrayals come out. They kind of burst out, and they get dealt with along with the fact that the protagonist, the composer, was beaten up as a child. And, in fact, the guy who beat him up is still there, still trying to beat him up. It's funny. And so you get this this wonderful man pushing everybody to move to a much higher level of spiritual and personal integrity. And all this yaya comes out and needs to be dealt with. And when I tell you, every family in every neighborhood is full of that yaya, because the corruption is, of course, at that level, including the financial corruption. And so you see this group of people clear it. They come clean individually. They come clean together. And as a result, they are able to produce something of great power and creativity, and to really live something and do something that is unbelievably authentic. And it is a marvelous movie. It's a fun movie to watch. Get your Kleenex box, because you are not, I've watched it three times. I can't watch it without the Kleenex box. But it is a metaphor for something that needs to happen for each one of us, and each one of us in collaboration with those we know and work with, because it's part of this coming clean and part of this clearing that we need if we're going to find a way to collaborate at a very intimate level with each other in a way that can get power and get something done on the big issues, again, faith, freedom, leadership, law, and love. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that's my comments on living in faith. It's really been a pleasure to finally talk about these things. It's kind of been building up for a long time. In closing, I'm going to be at the Long Beach Health Freedom Expo in Long Beach this weekend, Saturday, March 3rd. Got a speech at noon and then a panel with George Norrie at 3 o'clock. And then coming up, we've got, as I said, we've got subscriber lunches in Tucson, West Texas, and hopefully in San Jose that you'll be hearing more about as the subscriber updates come out. Next weekend, I'll be doing Precious Metals with Franklin. He'll be in Tennessee. I'll be in Ojai, California. We have an event the following Saturday. It's a hosting of Thrive and then a discussion about the Thrive documentary. Then the following week, I'll be talking to you from Tucson. We're going to be talking about the Comfort Call story and going deeply into the nuts and bolts of how you do an A-share, B-share model for a startup company and the issues involved with a wonderful entrepreneur. And then I'm also going to be talking with my attorney and a venture capitalist who is the treasurer for our Solaria Circle, Paul Ferguson. So ladies and gentlemen, until next week with Franklin Sanders on Precious Metals, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.